everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards that are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In the New in Chess podcast, we talk to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. Today's guest is Grandmaster Tiger Hiller Persson, a three-time Swedish champion and one of the most creative and non-standard players of our game. These days, Tiger divides his time between playing competitive chess, coaching, playing Go, writing books, and much more. Tiger has written two books on the modern defense, and now his latest book has come out with the intriguing title Tiger's Chaos Theory. That book, published by Quality Chess, was the reason I invited Tiger to the podcast. And I'm delighted that he accepted the invitation and joins us from Malmö. Hello, Tiger. How are you?
Hi, Dirk. Hi, Dirk-Jan. It's very nice to be here.
Great. Well, let me first say congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
I cannot say I read it, but I spent many hours with it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a wonderful book, a very personal book. I think it must mean a lot to you. Well, what were your feelings when you were first holding the book, after all the time you invested in it?
It was a lot of time. My partner will tell you how much time it was. Yeah, like you say, it's a very personal book because chess is very personal to me. I learned chess very late in life, and I didn't go to chess club until I was 14 years old. I learned things a bit different from other people. I probably read my first chess book before I played my first game, stuff like that. I always felt like an outlier in some way. And it also meant that I saw chess in a different way. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the second half of my chess life has been about trying to deal with some of the misconceptions I picked up in my earliest half.
Well, maybe that is one of the things I want to clarify right from the start. If I look at the book, on the back cover of the book, it says that you learned to play chess at the age of 11. Then on page 56, you say, I learned the rules and started playing the game with my father at the age of 12.
Yes.
And I remember the interview you had with Jesper Hall in 2000 in chess, and I said, where you said, because I started playing chess at the late age of 13, I had to find my own specific view on chess. So clarify us.
To be clear, I learned to play chess from an Icelandic kid, my own age. His name was Gisle, in Kiljava, in the summer of, I'm actually not sure whether it was 1981 or 1982. So I might have been almost 12 or almost 13. Mm-hmm. I've not looked it up.
No.
It's somewhere there.
Yeah.
And I actually knew a bit of the rules before that because I remember having played a game, but, you know, not knowing the details, not knowing how all the pieces moved, stuff like that. But I had a knee injury when I was 13. And at that time, I already had started playing chess with my father. So basically, my father taught me, and we played chess during late evening. Maybe I'm mentioning this in the book. I don't remember. But my father is a bird catcher. So we were out very late in the evenings, and we went out very early in the mornings to catch different sorts of birds. And there was this gap in the middle of the night where it was perfect for a chess game. So he taught me to play chess. He wanted, I played other games, and he thought, like, you know, chess is a proper game. Let's teach the kid that.
Yeah.
And he did. And I got strong pretty fast. So when I started in the club, I was already decent. And then I had a friend, I got this knee injury. I was operated twice. And on the second time I was in the hospital being operated, he brought a chess computer, and he said, it's the strongest one in the world. Mm-hmm. And it clearly was not. And I beat it on my first try. So, and then when I came back to school, I asked him, so what club are you playing for? And he brought me to his club, and I started playing.
That has been clarified. The other thing I want to see clarified, and it's Well, it's something that many people know, but people who, well, who meet you for the first time in this podcast, they obviously wonder, why are you called Tiger? Why are you called Tiger?
Yeah, I wish I could give a clear answer to that, because my mother, she came up with different stories every time I asked her. And she had, I mean, some of those stories were my favorites. So one of the stories she told, that she dated this guy in former Yugoslavia before I was born. She was a guide there and she lived there for some time. And there was this guy who she dated that had two sisters called Mashinka Mitrayes, which means approximately machine gun and some other kind of rapid firing pistol or something. And she thought when she was there, because in Sweden it's very common for people have very standard, or in those days had very standard first names, and she wanted me to be someone that if you call my name out in the street, I would know it was me they were calling for. And actually, I'm pretty sure it was prohibited for a long time to actually be called Tiger in Sweden, and because there are no other people called Tiger, and she probably tricked a priest or manhandled him in some way that made him make my name go through. And she told this story about basically going to him saying that Tiger is decided and my second name is Christopher Robin. And she said, Christopher is decided. And he, maybe as a joke, he said Robin, and she just said, yes, it's a deal. And then he had to stick with it, something like that. So okay. My full name is Tiger Christopher Robin.
So that is Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah.
You could. Was that the inspiration, or is that one of
my,
the versions?
My mother says it's a hard no on that, but I uh-huh. don't really believe her, or I didn't believe her when she was alive. So I think she was a good storyteller too, in her way.
And then was it Tiger from the start, or was there a Swedish version? It was
No, Tiger. I've been called Tiger since my first day.
Okay.
I think my mother had she had probably some. I mean, my first memories in life are from a feminist camp in Denmark. So she probably you know this song by Johnny Cash, Boy Named Sue.
Yeah.
Where this boy who has a father that gives him the name of Sue, and he has to then prove himself to be the manliest and toughest guy in all of the West.
Yeah.
And he finds his father, puts a gun to his head and said, why did you call me Sue? And he says, because I wanted you to become the person that you have become now. Like,
yeah.
And my mother probably thought that way around. She thought I should relax if I had a tough name or something. And I think she did well there. Yeah. I'm not very...
But what did it do to
many
you?
People, many of my friends, they called me the cat.
Uh-huh.
So,
as a nickname.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but maybe the Swedish version of kitty, you know, like a house cat. Yeah.
Yeah. But did it have an impact on you? I mean, is it something that puts some pressure on you? I mean, I think if you're doing a sport or if you're playing chess and your name is Tiger, then that presupposes not a very timid player. Or...
Yeah, I never felt any pressure from it. Mm-hmm. I felt I had some advantages from it, definitely, because if a journalist sees someone who's called Tiger, they're more prone to write about that person than someone who called, anything else, basically. So I think there were advantages to being called Tiger, and that maybe if I had not been called Tiger, I might not have become a chess player, who knows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you immediately embraced it in a very natural manner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's turn to the book, Tiger's Chaos Theory. As you agreed, a very personal book. How did it come about?
It started with Jacob asking me, or maybe I mentioned, I don't remember.
Jacob
it's such a long time ago.
Yeah.
I think Jacob was definitely involved in the thinking about it. And there is a Swedish... Carl-Fredrik Johansson, a friend of mine, we had talked about other books I could write, and he inspired me to write my first book on the modern. Mm-hmm. And it was to be about creativity. And then I spent two, three years, I wrote some stuff. And the more I thought about creativity, the less I felt that there was something really interesting to be written about it, about chess. I think that creativity in chess is a lot about, taking ideas that you find in one situation and you take them and you put them in a different situation. And also at some stage, I started writing a very, very big book, and Jacob, he told me, we don't want to publish an encyclopedia. So I had to...
You mean that was a different book? Or
yeah, that was a different book. Or that was a book about, you know, all manners of creativity. And a little of that made it into the book that is published now. I mean, the chapter of what's called Channeling Karpov, I believe it's called. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first chapters I wrote. And it was also one of the last chapters to actually make it into the book. Because that's something I wrote for a book that was maybe more about the mentality of being a chess player and how to think about winning and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the book is a chess book. It's about chess.
Well, your chess, I would say.
95% of it. Sorry?
I would say your chess, very much.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. In a sense.
No, because that's what I was thinking when I was looking at it, is that you present these games that had a... Maybe you should tell us something about this database that you created of games that had an impact on you and that sort of formed the cornerstone of your chess knowledge or
I bought my first laptop in 1996, just before the Politiken Cup, the year that I became second. I scored the second place there, shared. And I actually spent my last money on it. And I immediately, you know, I had like my own games. In those days, you had something like 100,000 games in a base. Mm-hmm. That was like the big base.
Yeah.
And then you had your own games and maybe something else. And when I found games that collided with my idea of how chess should be played, I put it in a base I called Interesting. And I, Joe, know that Jonathan Rowson would be upset with me for this. He always said that interesting is an empty word. It's something to say. It's a lazy word that means that you're not actually there to express something properly about something. Or that's how I understood. But in this sense, it was very interesting because I didn't know what to say about it yet.
Yeah.
So I put the games there, and eventually I comment them or I look them through. Maybe I just find one day, oh, this is very simple for me, and I just leave it, I put it away. But most of the games, they I comment them and I put them in other bases or with other themes. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I've developed my sense of, say, the fringe patterns in chess. And I mean, there are so many chess players that are stronger than me in the world, and there has always been. I've never been close to the top. My top rating was 26-18, and it was for like a few months just, and then I was back to the 2500s. So I've never felt really how it was to compete on the top. What been the thing that have carried me as a chess player is my interest for what is possible, you know, how far can you push the limits of material imbalances and still have a good position, stuff like that. It's what kept me alive and in love with chess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that when I was reading in the book, that at some point I got an idea that, well, people, they have these desert island books. And mostly what they choose is some classic or something that had a massive influence on them. And that's what they're going to take to their island. I thought this would be a desert island book for any chess player who loves the game. And I had this feeling, I mean, this is Tiger's, well, guided tour of his chess realm.
That's
what you like.
Very good description, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy that you felt that way. You're like one of the first people who give me some impressions back from a book. So I virtually met no one who read it so far. So you're the first. I'm very happy to hear that.
Well, it's fascinating that you... I mean, that there's... You're trying to build this theory while at the same time poking fun at the theory or slightly undermining it.
There is no theory. I'm basically telling you on the first page that there is no theory, and exactly. I'm also against the grand theory of chess. But I'm still giving hints. I'm putting lighthouses that can guide you to, lighthouses. One of the wonderful things about them is that depending on what direction you come close to them, they shine differently.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of principles you have to have in chess. They have to be very flexible because it's the devil and God and all other magical creatures are in the details.
Yeah.
And you should use your intuition and guidelines to point you towards the important parts of the game. Mm. But those should not be like rules. I don't like, rules of thumb, or at least I don't like the expression, and I try to keep them very, very loose.
Yeah, and there's also something poetic to it. I mean, you're lending, words from history, from philosophy. What I liked was this hecatomb. I mean, you see a chapter and it's called hecatomb. Then you think, what is this about? And it guides you in the world of big sacrifices, queen sacrifice. Is that something? Well, that's just a natural part of you. I mean, you like to read, you like the arts. It cannot be without that.
I cannot separate things that I'm interested in. For me, I think my strength and my difficulty is that for me everything is connected.
Mm-hmm.
I truly mean that, and it's.
So how did that hecatomb come?
You know me well enough to know that if you speak to me, I will say these kind of things. Suddenly, because they are there in my mind. These connections. So it's just.
When did it originate, or where did it come from? The hecatomb. I mean, what was it? Something that you were reading and you thought, well, maybe you should explain what it is and how you use it as an introduction to queen sacrifices.
I mean, I've been trying to. I hope that there are very few games in the book that have been published before, but there is one. I know of two games that have been published a few times that are in the book, and I'm trying to say some pretty new things about them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some others, but there is one game that I think all chess players in the world know about almost, which is Serpe against Nikolaidis.
Mm-hmm.
It's a King's Indian game where Serpe, he goes on to sacrifice all his pieces. And when I showed that game to students and so on, the word hecatomb, just, the 100 oxen sacrifice of the antiquity, I just felt the connection between that game and that's how it evolved from there, sort of.
Wasn't that the game that he called his own Mona Lisa? Or
I don't know.
I'm just thinking because there used to be Gufeld who was writing about.
Gufeld had a Mona Lisa. I know that one, but
and I think that I at think some point
they both deserve the Mona Lisa title. These games.
Well, Serpa, I think it was by way of a joke that he said, "I have my Mona Lisa too." Yeah. And so he was poking fun at that, but
I agree with him.
Yeah,
completely.
Actually, I should point out he's a very interesting writer. I agree with Serpa. Yeah, but that's something different.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Another game that you study in great detail is Gustav Auerbach, this classic.
Yes, and that's the one I'm trying to say something about, the details. That's part of the game. Mm. And I also feel that people have been a bit superficial about it and, telling a great story. I think I use it as an example of storytelling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also You know, I'm a storyteller. I mean, I hang around with storytellers. Most of my friends are storytellers, and as all storytellers know, it's really hard to stop.
Yeah.
At that point where your story is getting so good that you're starting like, yeah, this is the truth, but it's not such a great story. We'll just change a little bit here.
Yeah.
You know, you get to that stage where the story takes over, where truthfulness becomes your second aim, sort of.
Yeah.
And I think that everyone, if you want to get stronger at chess, you have to arrive at the point when you're objective about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. In order to grow. You don't have to be it during the game. You don't have to be it directly after the game. But if you want to get very, very strong, you should arrive at that point at some time. And I think that is to some extent a prerequisite.
Yeah.
If I pronounce it correctly, for improving fast.
Yeah. Well, it's as you say, it is a story. I mean, if you tell someone that this game is being analyzed for I don't know how many pages and going really deep into the variations, I mean, that might frighten people off. But they shouldn't be, because what I think the achievement is that you keep the story going. I mean, you're deep into the game or deep into the analysis, and it's still is an entertaining story. I think that's what you manage very, very well.
I think a lot of the credit goes to Andrew Greet there, who helped me with the editing. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the first book I'm writing where I'm telling stories, sort of, because the modern, there were fragments of stories there, but this is more, like you say, I'm trying I'm not just trying to tell how I view chess. I'm trying to tell people how I view chess, how that can be a problem, what I learned from that, and maybe if I have some unique insights, and I think I do actually, and if I can pass them on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also, you create these concepts. It's like Jonathan Rowson, who created the zebra concept. Yeah.
Which I use.
I think the great thing about that is that if it appeals to you and you get the metaphor, then it sticks with you, and it's incredibly helpful. So how hard do you work on finding these well, let's call them metaphors?
Yeah, you know, I find a few quaggas also, and it turns out they were dead before I found them, and I need to bury them just. But I find a lot of zebras because I'm looking for them. I'm a zebra watcher.
Some people might not know the zebra. Explain them to.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I'm quoting Jonathan in the book, but he uses the zebra to. He says that if he's quoting. Would you say a parable, or what is the word in English? Sorry.
A Sufi saying it was, I think.
Yeah, a Sufi saying that if you hear the hooves of the horses, think of a zebra.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a way of saying that just because something feels obvious, you should be open to the possibility that it could be something else.
Yeah.
There could be more to this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like when people, especially in the Nordic countries where we've got a lot of pine forests, when kids paint pines, they just do the zigzag, 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 and you see these pictures where it's just zigzags over the top of the picture and the blue sky, and I think. In order to become really, really strong at a complex game like chess or like Go, you need to look through that pattern. You need to look beyond it and see that there are pine cones and some are leaning and some are, you know, it's don't get fixed on the most obvious pattern, which is the beating of the horse hooves.
Yeah. Is it also a reaction to the... the repetition way of learning chess. You're looking for these patterns, or you're exercising an opening, and you're repeating those moves, and you're repeating those moves, and at some point your queen automatically goes to b6, and it may be efficient, but it's not very romantic.
I mean, it all comes down to meaning. Yeah. How do you get meaning from something? Mm-hmm. And for me, I became a chess player because chess was deeply meaningful to me in ways it's not now. I've changed. Chess has changed. Mm-hmm. But I derive meaning from teaching, from many different things. But in my own chess, this looking for the things that are not obvious, the patterns that are not easily seen, this gives meaning to my own study, to my relationship with chess becomes better through that.
Oh yeah, you might also argue that in a way it is much easier to remember certain concepts. But what I loved was one of your first conversations you had with Jonathan Rowson, and he asks you, he says, do you know the secrets of the Russian? The big secret of the Russians? And you think it's a joke. And then he says, well, they talk to their pieces.
Yeah.
And then once you start thinking about that and you give examples of that, then it sticks with you. I mean, it's impossible to forget.
I've used this since 1996. That's when this took place. So for 28 years, I've been actively speaking with my pieces. I actually... sometimes just to snap out of when my mind becomes stale, and when I'm just feeling there's nothing really happening. I'm looking at the position, but I'm not seeing it. Mm-hmm. I just take a step back and I go through the major piece. I start with the queen and say, what do you want to do? And the queen says, I don't want to do anything yet. You know, it's a beehive out there, and I prefer to stick in the hive.
Yeah.
Or I prefer to be in the hive, and then you ask the rooks, and they say, it's a bit too early in the game, but there's an open file there. Can we take it? Yeah, but we might get exchange. And you get these discussions, which are really discussions with yourself and your opinions.
Yeah.
But it clarifies things. And I go through the pieces like that.
And is it part of you're teaching chess to students?
I do.
They have to reproduce their conversation with the pieces, or
and I hope they move on from that, because I also I don't believe in the grand theory of chess. Maybe I should. I'm not claiming that I'm right in not doing it. I don't think it's human. You know, maybe one day when we become AI enhanced, we can find a grand theory that actually shine with a human mind, sort of. But I still don't think there is. And so it's important to find these through language, to find ways that make you understand why things are the way they are. So I give one example in the book about material, where I've always been very skeptical about material being the basis of the evaluation. Yeah. And I think the era of computers has made that the strongest single factor in evaluation. Maybe it was before. I didn't live then, so I don't know. But I think it's exaggerated. I didn't have a way to explain why. You know, someone asked me, what's so great about material?
Oh, well,
most chess players can't answer that. They would go like, they're good in the end game, or you know, it's like, and I like this explanation that if you have less material, you have to avoid all those lines where there are exchanges. So basically you're there are much less candidate moves, and eventually that will shrink until there is nothing less, unless you can get something from that material, because endgame is coming eventually. So it's a slippery slope in a sense.
That was one of the headings that stuck with me. I mean, what's so special about material? I like that a lot. It sets you thinking immediately, and then you philosophize about it, and you give your views. And it sticks. So that's And you even brought in Houdini, one of my heroes.
One of mine too. And many I guess you know about the time he tricked the Tsar to almost hire him. You heard that anecdote of when he made the bells of the Kremlin chime.
Refresh my memory.
I will tell. It's a long story. I will tell it another.
But the good thing is, I mean, many young players, they may think that Houdini is a chess program, but of course, it's not. He's the greatest illusionist of all time, and I think his life story.
And he was so far ahead of his time, because he was so important for him that the illusions that he did were illusions. He never ever pretended. That it was anything else. And he actually had to really talk to people to explain to them, this is an illusion. And they were like, no, you're a magician. And he said, no, I'm not a magician. I mean, he went really far to, and he also spent a lot of time on showing that fraudsters were not real and stuff like that. He was a fabulous person.
Yes.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Well, you bring in all those themes or concepts that you give great names, but then there's other things. I just wrote them down, Tiger, and I want to read them. I can get carried away by things that sound better than they really are, such that the narrative gets the better of the truth that I'm seeking, and I think that's such a great thing to say. Well, okay, we've had all this so-called theory. But let's not exaggerate. I mean, there's and then you have this the motto of chapter 10, where you give this quote from Tom Waits: "Never trust a man in a blue trench coat. Never drive a car when you're dead."
I'm so happy that you got that. Yeah. It's like when you choose. It was the last quote that I chose for the book.
Yeah,
and I found it in it because it's a parody of knowledge in a sense and of structure and everything. So yeah, I'm very happy that you liked that.
Yeah, I just have to imagine his raspy voice with it.
Yeah.
So, but let's say it's a very personal book, and you present highlights from your own career, other highlights that you discovered, and you put them into some sort of it is a theoretical frame, but you draw lessons from them, and I think you will learn from, I mean, you will actually learn things from studying these games with your explanations, but at the same time, it's also getting you into your world. So how does this book compare or relate to the other things that fascinate you? I mean, you, from your blog, I understand that you play way too much Go.
I think I play way too little, personally. I would like to play much more.
Well, and I know you're absolutely devoted to music. So all these things they play a big role in your life. How do they play a role in this book or the origins of this book?
I believe in a way that creatively speaking, chess has always been my medium.
More than music?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I I'm a music freak. I'm even thinking of tattooings some cell parts from the Schubert string quintet on my arm. So at the moment, I'm crazy into some parts of music history. But I play the piano, and I'm decent at it. But I play other people's stuff. I learn. I'm a listener most of all. And the same with, I guess, my main interests in apart from music, and I'm very interested in politics and history and stuff like that. And I think you have to use all of your mind to grasp the world. I find the world interesting. I find birds interesting. You know, people used to make fun of me for the fact that I love birds so much. But, and you know, if someone asked me what's so great about birds, they fly. It's just a mic drop there. You know, it's they're just magical creatures. I don't understand why people, you know, have to chase Pokemons and magical monsters and stuff like that. We have magical beings living among us, sort of, and yeah. It makes me very happy. So,
but that was instilled by your father,
connection?
I guess.
I think the connection is that I have this part in my life that has always been connected to creativity very much, and I wanted to share that. I don't think it's much more than that.
Yeah. But then, let's say chess, when you discovered it, was that the thing that triggered your hunger for creativity most?
There were other things in those days. It's strange. I have very little memory of myself when I was really young. Before my 16th birthday, I remember my love for chess. I remember this feeling of when which I rediscovered this feeling with Go at the age of 40, which was that if someone told me, you know, should we go to the zoo? Should we go to a Tivoli or the amusement park? Or, you know, should we have a party? And I would be like, yeah, we could do that, but, you know, wouldn't you prefer to play a game of chess? Because, you know, it's more fun.
Yeah.
And of course, that wasn't socially very acceptable when you were 13 years, when I came to this feeling.
Yeah.
But eventually I learned through my obsession with chess that obsessions make you build a place inside of you where you can retreat to whenever you want to, and that is just the best thing to have. So I think my obsession with chess fed my other obsessions, or loves, or what you want to call them.
Yeah, because that's the feeling I got, that at some point it borders on religious feelings. I mean, the way you dedicated yourself to chess at a rather advanced age for a talent. I mean, you're describing this Politiken Cup tournament in 96, so you're 26 years old or 25. Yeah. And then you don't have money to, and you need money, so you sleep in a sports hall, and when you describe that you fold your jeans to use it as a pillow, then I think there's a monk there.
I come from a family where money means very, very little, almost to a dysfunctional level. I've never been very good at getting paid. It's one of those, you know, it's like one of my best friends, he always said, why work? And with that, he didn't mean that he didn't do a lot of things, because he did a lot of things. I mean, he was one of the most creative people I've ever met. He just said, you know, why get paid for it? Doesn't matter to me. I'm doing things because I just feel I should do them. And I've always gravitated towards that place. And it's not the best of ways to live your life sometimes, because money is good also for other reasons.
Yeah.
But I've been quite true to the things that I like through life.
Yeah. I mean, they really are so important that, okay, other things, they can wait, because this has to be attended to.
I think I live very privileged life in a sense. You know, what I say, when I say that, you know, I didn't care about money, it comes from a very privileged place, because I knew that, you know, if something went wrong or something, I had my family, I had my my partner, she would back me up. You know, I've never been at risk of ending up in the street or something like that. And then it's much easier to say something like that. I'm very well aware of that.
Yeah. But then let's say you're teaching these days, so that's part of your income. When you're playing Go, then it's in fact the old story. I mean, I don't think there's much money in
No, Go. There's no. And yeah. I like that, you know. I'm a rather strong amateur in Go. I play for the Swedish national team now and then, and there are absolutely no prize money for amateurs. There is actually a system where you have to become a professional and then you play like in a separate part of the tournament, and they have prize money and we don't. And I don't find that the least problematic. Also, the difference between levels in Go is much bigger. In chess, we have like, I don't know what you call this in English, but like in the old ocean steamers, you had these compartments that were watertight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we have like three of those in chess. So if you have 1,000 in rating, you will not beat someone who has 1,700. And if you have 1,700, you will not beat someone who's 2,400. And if you're 2,400, you're very unlikely to beat the strongest in the world.
Yeah.
It's like three compartments where it's really, really hard to beat the upper part of the, but in Go there are like 35.
Oh really?
Yeah. So it also means that if you're stronger than someone else, it's so obvious. There's no doubt there. It's very black and white. much more so than chess.
Well, I was thinking, well, you have this passion for music, and I'm just curious where you are right now. There, I remember that the last conversation we had, and that's probably 10 or 15 years ago in was it Copenhagen or was it Malmö? I forgot. We got to talk, and before I knew it, I thought we were going to talk chess. Before I knew it, we were talking Beethoven string quartets. And I liked the recordings of Elvenberg Quartet, and you told me that was totally wrong. I should go for the I should go for the Lindsays.
I was a bit harsher in those days with these things than I am now. I'm much more mellow, and my friends make fun of me all the time because of this, because there's a little snob living within me. I don't like him at all. I'm trying to keep him at bay.
Well, you know him, so that helps. I mean,
yeah.
But what are the what are the composers that you are listening to most at the moment?
Well, I had 2 years when I was obsessed with Scriabin. I almost listened to nothing else. I actually started out on a bus in Turkey when I was talking about music. I was talking music with Peter Wells. And he just very backhandedly mentioned something about Scriabin's sonatas. And I'm not sure that he knew very much about them either. But I just kept that thought there.
Yeah.
And I'd listened to them when I was very young, because my stepfather had a very extensive music library. And they didn't catch on then. So eventually one of my favorite pianists, what's it? Amelin.
Oh, yeah. Marc-André?
Marc-André Armelin. He made a recording of them, and I just thought, yeah, I'm getting that one. And then I listened to it.
Yeah.
And I was lying at home on the sofa in the living room listening to them when Lucia got home after work, and she was laughing at me. And she said, can you listen to this?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know yet, but I feel I'm getting there.
Yeah.
And then one day I just got there, and then I just absolutely loved it. I listened to nothing else. I played Scriabin, but this is like 10 years ago. Lately, I've been, during the pandemic, I always played the piano, and I always played it like you pat a cat. You know, I sit down at the piano, I just empty my head and I play a bit, and it's not for anyone else but me.
Yeah.
But suddenly, I had a lot of time on my hands. I bought a better piano, and I became ambitious. So, and since then, I've listened mostly to things that I play. So, a lot of Chopin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to play the.
You know that Hamelin, he has this recording of Chopin with one hand.
Yeah. The Godowsky etude. Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah.
I just wish they had filmed his hand more. I listened to Marc-André because the Chopin competition is next year, and they are now having concerts beforehand showcasing it. And there was a concert with Hamelin just like 2 days ago, I think. I posted it where he played the Ravel, the Scarborough, what is it called, the thing. And he also played this Forest Scenes by Schumann, and I absolutely love that. And I love when someone like Hamelin plays it because he has the most beautiful technique and it's very simple music.
Mm.
It's very simple. And maybe the simplest thing Schumann ever wrote, some parts of it at least. And he plays it so beautifully. He really focuses on the counterpunctual melodies and stuff like that. Loved it.
No, he's brilliant.
You love chess. Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
At the end of the book, you say, 20 years ago, I considered chess as a form of art, but now I see it more as a science.
Yeah.
In a way, at the end of such a romantic book, I would say that sounds a bit sad. Is it that?
Yeah, I think I've been fighting with my attitude towards chess for the last 15 years, and the jury is out, and it will continue to be out. I have to, it's the new normal is that the jury is out for me. Some days I feel inspired and I feel that there is something to learn and to play and something to discover. And then there are days when I feel that it's been overanalyzed and that that the creative margins are so small that I'm not sure I'm interested in it anymore. It's fluctuating for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what I love with chess. I know what the things are that I really like about it. And lately, for instance, I've not played the modern for the last 2 or 3 years. And it's not so much because it's unplayable. It's more that you have to now choose lines where you land on your back foot very early on in the game. And if you play it the way I used to play it, you're open to all kinds of very sharp preparations. And the engines now are so strong. I think when I wrote my last book on the modern, the engines were still so... I mean, they were incredibly strong, but I could still find holes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And various, for instance, there's one idea that I missed in one chapter where White just plays h4, h5, which is the kind of idea that I would play myself. But I looked at it so much from the black side that I missed it. And the engines, they weren't strong enough to see it. And then suddenly one day, one engine just went h5 in that position. It's a big advantage for White. And it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big advantage. It's one of the biggest holes in my book. But I think it's pretty well known now.
But what is your attitude there? Because I would think, okay, it's a hole.
I'm going to pick it up again.
Yeah.
But I have a big part of my opening repertoire went from being perfectly playable to deeply suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
In about, it took maybe 1.5 years,
mm-hmm.
there around the pandemic. So when I came out on the other side of that, most of the openings that I've made my living from, you could not make a living from them anymore. Maybe I can play them in occasional games, but you know, I played the modern Benoni with King C Indian, the modern defense, some other fishy lines, and I realized that I had to focus much more on my white repertoire, and that I had to learn some more solid things with black.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time on that. And for a long time, in the last 3 years, for instance, I started playing the Catalan with black. and like every second game, I get to positions that I've never seen before.
Hmm.
So although I feel a bit sad that I feel I have to play that kind of thing, it's also an adventure for me because other people play it all the time, but I haven't. So it's a bit new for me. And there's some fun in that.
Yeah. Well, what does it do to you as a teacher? I mean, if I look at the book, I mean, there's so much wisdom in it, so much richness. And then, in fact, the students, they want to score points. And maybe this is not entirely the way. Maybe they should repeat all those openings 100 times. Well, how do you deal with that?
It's a very, very good question. Very good question. And it's also, please remind me that I said this in a few years. I always thought, you know, the moment I don't want to play chess anymore, I don't want to teach it either. Why teach something that I don't like to do myself? For me, there's a deep conflict in me. I'm not sure I will be. Maybe I will. Maybe I will just compromise and make a living. And maybe the compromise will become easier. Maybe I will change my, you know, something could change. But that is how I feel now.
Hmm.
So I feel that I have to get to a place because I've been stressed about the developments, the whole chess world, there's been this exodus towards classical openings and putting pawns in the center at the earliest possible stage and taking space. And I've been a proponent of a hypermodern school for most of my life. And to some extent, when it comes to the hypermodern part, I've come to the conclusion that, you know, my evaluations were wrong. I overestimated many of these positions, for instance, in the modern Benoni. Objectively, they were not as good as many other people tried to tell me they were not as good as, but they couldn't prove it to me. But now I think the proof is out there that you know, playing e5 against e4 and d5 against d4 is very solid.
Is it a relief then that the new generation of top players, that they are very creative players?
Yes, I think it is. And you know, I've come, when I finished the book, I actually finished it a while ago, and then we had the editing process and so on. I've been gaining interest in chess as a game that I'm invested in myself, because we have always teaching and other parts. So I'm really looking forward to the next half year. I'm looking forward further, but now I'm like, I really want to play. I've learned so many. I talk about this in the book, but I say that to learn is to unlearn. And I was through such a process very, very much in 97, 98. I had a similar 10 years later in 2007, 2008. I went through another period of that. And I've gone through a period now where I've learned more classical systems and become more serious with things like the call spot structure and stuff like that, which I actually taught a lot. So, and the more I do that, the more interested I become in that part of chess. So maybe in 15 years, I will write another book, and it will be the most boring book you've ever read. But I will love it.
Yes, well, that's one thing I can say about this book, that it's far from boring, far from boring. And what I think is so wonderful is that investigations. At some point, there is this. You have this opening idea in the Grünfeld with this sacrifice. And essentially, it's a failure. And you don't believe it, and you work.
You know, the failure with it is that no one walks into this line anymore. Because if they did, I would play it. I really would. I would play it again and again and again. Because it's, even though the engines now, you know, like when I found this idea, the engine said it was plus 3.5 or something like that for black. I remember it was just out of the book to play it. I was like, no, I think this is compensation. They're down to 1.5 or something like that. So the engines have they suddenly see some of the reason behind my why I like this. But I don't get the positions because there are other ways for black to avoid it earlier on.
But
I would be happy to play like a three-game match against someone strong when I play the white pieces from that position.
I will repeat. I like the book a lot, and I think there's a lot to be learned there. But it's mainly for me. I mean, this is the kind of book that is a joy to read and to play through, because it shows so much of the beauty of the game and the depth and the stories. I mean, there's lots of stories So, well, thank you very much for that, Tiger, and I already look forward to your next book. We have to wait 15 years, and we may think it will be different.
Yeah, there might be something earlier than that, but it will be on a completely different subject.
No, but I think that it's absolutely great that you did this. It's a very personal book, and it says a lot about your passion for chess and your knowledge of the game. And I was just thinking, the amount of hours that not only went into analysis, but then probably additionally went into the writing of the book. I mean, probably you shouldn't calculate how many there were.
But it was. My partner has definitely told me not to write books like this again.
No.
For my own sake. Yeah. She's worried about my mental health.
Were there moments where you got desperate?
No. But it was, you don't make money from spending 8 years thinking about and then start writing after 3 years and then, you know, getting to all kinds of, but I'm still very happy about it. It was a book that I needed to write, and now it's done.
Very good. So don't play too much Go. Stay with us a bit.
I'm coming back a bit now.
Oh, very good. I look forward to that, Tiger. And once again, thanks a lot for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If you liked Tiger's stories about his book and you would like to buy it, you can do so in our webshop on newinchess.com. There you will find Tiger's Chaos Theory and many more great chess books for players of all levels. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.